Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast, now with extra funny bits.
Funny bits may not be that funny and can be withdrawn at any point. Subject to status, do not pass go, do not collect £200, keep your hands inside the carriage at all times.
And the guy with the funny eyes says, haven't you ever heard of tuna mayo? Anyway, right, what are we doing here today?
Well, I'm glad you asked that,
John, what's
Dave,
the plan?
Because today we are here to talk about writing and more particularly bad writing.
Well, we should be experts on that by now, shouldn't we?
Is it a good book or a bad book? Does it irk you or does it mollify? Can the author really write or is it merely shite? I don't know. I'm not really qualified.
To give the listeners an idea of where this came from, I was thinking about the qualities that make good writing, but also what the qualities of bad writing are in order, hopefully, to try and avoid them. Yeah, and I thought it might be quite an interesting thing to look at.
Yes, and you've wanted to do this for a while.
And it's
you,
quite
John?
Good fun, isn't it? Mocking people that have tried really hard to succeed and got the work out there, isn't it? It's good to...
Well, exactly.
Just to fire pot shots from behind our very impenetrable wall of unpublished failure.
Yeah. No, that is absolutely not what we want to do today. It is merely to talk about...
It is actually an interesting question, though, isn't it? Because when we talked about this on a little bit on Twitter ages ago, months ago, and there was a little bit of people, you know, said, well, how dare you? What gives you the right to ask what rubbish writing is or what the worst book you've ever read is? And it's a bit of a weird thing with writing that people feel that there isn't, you're not allowed.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you're allowed with films.
Well, yeah.
You're allowed to go to a film and go, do you know what? I think that's a bit rubbish. Well, you don't live in Hollywood. You've never made a film. Or do you mean, you go to the football and say, oh, that's rubbish. Why has he done that? He shouldn't have passed it there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're very
protective. You've never played professional football, but there seems to be
Yeah, we're very protective of our fellow writers, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think understandably as well, because it's less... Maybe because it's less collaborative a lot of the time. So you're out there. You're kind of out there naked on your own, aren't you?
Yeah.
I think part of it is the amount of effort it takes to actually get to that point.
Yeah.
And once you're in the writing mind, if you like, you know the vulnerability of it. You know the effort. It's all these... And then to see some jumped up unpublished idiot to go, oh, that's rubbish, that is.
But we've talked about reviews before, haven't we? And there are some people, because, you know, in the sort of writing community, there's this question about whether it's okay to give a bad review or whether you should just not. You know, that whole, oh, if you haven't got anything good to say, don't say anything at all. But actually, you know, if you're going to put work out there, you've got to be prepared for some people to not like it, surely. And if someone doesn't like what you've done, then surely they're entitled to say that.
I think so, yeah. The other thing that interests me is what is it about it that makes it bad? Because, like, over and above putting the words in the right order, is it just about taste? Or are there actual, you know, definite qualities that make objectively bad writing?
I think both those things can be correct at the same time.
Mm.
I think there's some of it that is taste. And you can not like something or like something, but there is some stuff that just when everyone agrees it's bad, then it's bad, isn't it? Really, I think that's majority rules on that, really.
Which weirdly doesn't seem to happen that often. Like everyone just piles in and goes, "That's terrible."
Not really, and then
it seems to be quite rare.
We kind of set ourselves the task of finding some of those to send to each other, didn't we, to discuss?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is about those, they end up becoming sort of famous in their own right for being bad and then kind of get a weird following because they're bad.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Isn't, like, at some point, isn't it better to be either really good at something or really bad at something? Like, the worst place to be...
On a podcast called the Failing Writers Podcast.
No, the worst place to be is slap bang in the middle.
Yeah.
Where it's not good enough for anyone to go, that's good, but not bad enough for it to be popular in any way. Just a complete...
So that's my plan from here. Rather than churning out mediocre stuff, I thought, what I'm going to do, I'm going to write absolute rubbish. Yeah. So
force everything down here.
And gain a massive following.
A massive ironic following.
Could you? Yeah. It's an interesting question. Could you do it, though, Tom? Could you do it? Like, the effort involved in making taking
well, after
something
reading your book last week, Dave, I feel like you've stolen a march on us all, to be honest.
There is that, but I mean, like, there's a lot of effort involved in taking something that's quite good and taking it up a notch to something that's really, really good. I think there's would be quite a lot of effort involved for you
it would be
to make it
just as hard.
Yeah, exactly, to deliberately make it awful. Like, I think you'd really struggle with
I'm not
that.
Sure. I think I'd be quite good at
it. Oh, no, I think you'd be quite good at it, John. I think Dave was saying I'd struggle. I think, yeah, I think I would struggle with that, Dave, to be honest.
But it's also in how you read stuff as well. Like,
that's
if you're...
That is really... Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, hang on. Yeah. You're saying, yeah. What do you mean, Dave? I don't understand.
What I mean is, if you're not a very good reader, you know, I just mean, like, we are essentially professional readers, right? We, as voiceovers, we take other people's words and we read them in a way that makes them sound interesting, hopefully, even if they're not. So in a certain way, we could read something and make it sound as exciting as it possibly
Completely,
could be.
Yeah.
But if that's not your thing, if you're not like a good reader in that sense, I don't mean someone who can't read, but, you know, if you're not a sort of exciting reader, you could take something that's actually quite well written and make it sound awful.
And vice versa, but I think if someone says, right, this is a bad piece of writing, you read it with that
yes.
in mind, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
And blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
Oh, this sentence is so long. Blah blah blah. Whereas if someone says, oh, this is one of the best pieces of writing. This is amazing. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Then you don't. You give it a bit more reverence and a bit more time.
Yeah. Expectation is a big thing, isn't it?
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can explore that because I've tried to set up a little experiment. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'll work.
Like one of these dodgy 1950s psychology experiments where we need to be electrocuted for it to work.
Yeah. What we're going to do at some point, we're gonna read some stuff and we're going to see if we can figure out if it's good or bad.
Says who?
Well, as in, what's a good way of putting this? We're going to take
like
some
whether
stuff.
Whether it's critically acclaimed
yes,
or whether
so
it's considered a terrible piece of writing.
We will read a passage of something that's acclaimed as being good and read a passage of something that's acclaimed as being bad, but not tell each other which is which and see if we can guess.
But we have to read it with the verve and gusto that we would normally read things with, right?
Yes.
Or we don't. That's... Maybe we don't. Maybe it's the double bluff. Maybe we prove that.
Wait a minute.
Exactly.
Maybe
this
we
is
prove
what
that
makes
point.
This is what makes it like a game show.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I said, if you can fit that up there, then you've got bigger problems. Oh, sorry. You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Can we talk about some things, the qualities that we think make bad writing? Because I'm interested in what the specific things that you think make bad writing. If you can sort of pinpoint them.
Yeah, something that really bothers me is like over-explanation of stuff. Too much detail.
Yeah.
I like stuff that just gets to the point. But this is the thing. I know a lot of
That's
people
That's a taste
love,
thing, though, isn't it? That's
love a bit more detail. Yeah, like it to go on
That's
and
subjective.
On.
Subjective.
But yeah, I like it sort of.
Some people like to know every detail of the teacup that they drank from.
Yeah.
Do you mean the ornate blah, 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 blah teacup? You're thinking, just get what? I want to know, is he drinking the poison or not?
Yeah.
But that's a taste thing. But I think the trick is if there isn't any room for inference or interpretation, that's the problem, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? If everything's explained so perfectly that there's nothing to kind of latch onto, there's no inference to be made, that's when it gets bad, as in that's bad writing.
And also, I don't know if it's the difference between sort of writing and storytelling, because some people are particularly good at telling stories, but like, you know, a good sort of raconteur strips a story down. You know what I mean? Like, just leave the sort of important bits, the funny bits or the interesting bits in some way. Some people, and I won't mention any names here, but someone I know pretty well, I often say that when they tell a story, it's like watching an episode of 24 because events occur in real time. So if it's like something that took an hour to happen, it'll take her an hour to describe
if you're
it.
Lucky. If not a little bit longer.
Exactly, yeah. And people who will say things like, to cut a long story short and then spend another half an hour talking about something. So some people, you know, are just sort of better storytellers.
Yeah, it's like Uncle Colm in
in
Derry Girls. Who later on in the series is used as a weapon because of his ability to talk the hind legs off a donkey.
People like that, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But presumably if somebody talks like that and then they decide to start writing, maybe they'll use the same kind of language when they're writing.
Yeah, or it would be interesting if someone like that would actually become, whether they'd want the writing to be like that,
yeah,
or whether they themselves would get annoyed. Oh, this is over-explaining everything.
Yeah.
And then they tell you the next day. So I was reading this book yesterday. It was it's about 4 or 5 centimetres deep, blue cover.
So yeah, that's my first bugbear.
I think that's a good one.
I don't know if that's about bad writing, but
I think a classic one is, and something that came up in what I was reading was the purple prose, over ornate prose that basically just completely detracts the reader from the narrative, like a impenetrable God knows what to try and read through.
Yes, and that's, do you know what? What's even worse is when it, instead of it being purple prose, it's just the odd purple word. So when you can tell that somebody's just found a word and decided to stick that in to just fluff.
Yeah, almost that they've gone, not many people will know this word.
They'll have to look this one up.
That doesn't help you, right? If people have to stop and look up a word,
yeah,
that's not clever.
I was in this book. I can't remember who it was. Was it you, John, that sent me this one?
What is it?
The Empress Teresa.
Oh, yeah, that was me.
That was a brilliant example of it. Oh, yeah, so the book, it's been... There's really, really simple language in the opening part. Some woman I didn't know was standing next to me. She looked to be in her early 20s and had a friendly smile. Hi, I said, with a young kid's taciturnity. It just like suddenly jumped out of nowhere, been like single syllable words all the way through. What, taciturnity?
What about you, John? What's your, number one gripe? Can you narrow it down to one?
I could narrow it down to a couple, I reckon.
Yeah.
Just like... ugly language. Do you know what I mean? Just like clunky.
Oh, you're going to have to... Is that not very subjective?
I think it probably is subjective, but when... I think it's probably to do with reading out loud and what we do for a living.
Yeah.
But there are certain...
Yes.
Things that just don't work. And there are things that do work. And it becomes incredibly obvious when you read it out loud. You can tell, I think, quite often, somebody who's read something back out loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or just kept it in their head.
Do you find that with a lot of like scripts that you voice?
Yeah,
I do. Sometimes you get a script and you think, this person wrote this down and then didn't read it after they wrote it and sent it.
Basically, if it's hard to say it out loud, it shouldn't be in your book, I think.
Yeah.
Because it makes us look rubbish.
Exactly.
It's that thing, isn't it? If there's a word repeated on the previous line or something.
Yes.
It takes you out of unintentional rhymes as well
and things like that.
You got to be aware of them all while you're writing through it. But I guess if you're not aware, you're just not aware, are you? There's no way of...
No, exactly. It's not even necessarily a grammar thing, because sometimes
if you
stick to the exact way grammar should be, it sounds shit. So you should almost kind of mess with the rules a little bit to make it work.
I think you get away with that one. That can go in room 101.
All right, thanks. Also, a really bad metaphor or a really cliched metaphor is it can just destroy a line. Whereas a really beautiful, intuitive metaphor, it's like a little gift.
Yeah.
It's turning a light on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a little metaphor there for you.
Is that not the difference? That's the difference between okay writing and great writing, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily make it bad.
But it helps you see the world from a different angle.
Yeah, yeah. There's a few writers like that. Laura Barton, that I said we'd like to get on the show. The way she writes, there's just some...
Oh, yeah.
There's some bits in her writing and it's just like beautifully formed metaphors that if you're not paying attention just sort of slide past because they fit into it so brilliantly.
Mm.
And then when you actually hear them, you think, oh God, yeah. And it just, you know, they're brand new and they're fresh.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's quite hard work doing that though, isn't it? It's much easier using old ones.
It is coming up with new metaphors.
Well, I often think the same thing about like really good swearing as well. Like, what was it, like in The Thick of It with Malcolm Tucker?
Mm.
He constantly came up with brilliant new ways to swear. I think Amanda Iannucci is particularly good at finding new ways to swear, but without it sounding like they're trying to force a new swear word into the lexicon. It's just they flow beautifully, flowing.
They flow beautifully.
Curses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arundhati Roy, the God of Small Things writer. She is a master of metaphor. There's almost like a metaphor in every line, but they're all like amazing. Like it could be just totally over the top, but because they're so good, it just flows. It's really good.
Do you have any examples of these, John?
I should probably have thought of that, shouldn't I? Mm-hmm. Before I said
really,
it.
I would really like to hear some right now.
I'll tell you what. Come back in 5 seconds after this little musical interlude and give you some.
And now we take a short break from our regular programming to welcome the marvellous world of metaphors with your host, Mr. Jonathan Rand. And this week he delves into the work of Booker Prize winner Arundhati Roy and her wonderful book, The God of Small Things.
So, Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things, it's like the whole book is just one big lesson in simile and metaphor. And obviously some of these are going to be a little bit out of context, but I think you'll get the gist. Like, Christianity arrived in a boat and seeped into Kerala like tea from a tea bag. That's just so perfectly fitting. You know, however you look at it, it's got everything. It's got connotations of imperialism. It's got the sort of the kind of warm way in which Christianity is presented to the country. That is it's a metaphor with flavor, that one. Then the next one, they just come thick and fast. Comrade Pillai himself came out in the mornings in a graying Artex vest, his balls silhouetted against his soft white mundu. He oiled himself with warm peppered coconut oil, kneading his old loose flesh that stretched willingly off his bones like chewing gum. That's a lovely visual simile. Okay, a bit of a spoiler now, so maybe if you're intrigued enough to read this fantastic book, you might want to hit the skip ahead 30 seconds button here. I don't think it actually ruins the experience of reading it, but there is a tragic death in the story that has resounding consequences for the characters. But this is a good metaphor, it's just clean. The loss of Sophie Moll stepped softly around the IM&M house like a quiet thing in socks. I just love that. I think it sort of suggests this weird looming presence. It's like a monster that's trying not to upset anyone, but by doing that is actually making their presence even more obvious. What else have we got? Rahel's new teeth were waiting inside her gums like words in a pen. It's nice, isn't it? That's a writer's simile. Histamon! He would call out in his high piping voice, frayed and fibrous now like sugarcane stripped of its bark. That's so good. She can just wrap a perfect simile into anything. It's not just concepts, but also all of the smells and the sights and sounds of India just come to life.
Brilliant. Those are really good metaphors, though.
Other things? Anything else?
Well, this is the thing. Like, some of these, or a lot of these so far, have been sort of mechanical things about writing. But sometimes you can read something and think, there's nothing technically wrong with this. It's just flat, you know? It's just not...
It's got nice words.
Yeah. And they're all sort of in the right order, but it's not doing anything. It's that... Yeah. I don't know.
That's probably just character, isn't it? Like, you don't care about the characters. Characters are too passive, or they don't have a clear goal, or they don't have a clear flaw that needs work.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Part of that, but then also, I don't know if this is a thing that just... There's a big argument, isn't there, about what things that can be taught and learned and things that are just sort of inherent. But I think some people just have a way with words that when they write something, it sounds interesting. And some people just don't have that, you know? And I know there are some people who would argue that that's not fair or true, and that anyone could learn to write.
It's absolutely not fair. But that's life, isn't it? I mean, some people can kick a football better than someone else. But I mean, the point is, I think with anything like this, the point always is, there's some people that are naturally talented. There's some people that can work to become better at it. But then you've got the brilliant people, the ones that are talented and work at it as well.
Well, yes, that is very true.
So I think there is something in that. I think there is a natural appreciation of, like John was saying before, that kind of, you know, thinking about the balance of sentences or how it flows or what's... All kinds of stuff about all the things you should be thinking about sentence length and stuff. Mm. You know, really good writers don't need to be consciously considering that all the time because it's happening for them.
Yeah,
it's just obvious when you write.
But you can still learn stuff like that, and it can become second nature. Mm. And then there's other people that just will never learn that or just don't even see it as a point to be aware of.
Yeah.
Which I guess is where we get to probably the books that we've sent each other to some extent. Do you mean when there's just
Because there's like, some of this stuff that that I've been reading, like I reached a point with it where I thought, he must know, like the guy who wrote this, he must know that this isn't very good. And I thought, or does he? Does he know? Is he aware that this isn't very good? And then I started wrapping myself in circles and thinking, maybe he's deliberately making it bad, because how could you accidentally be this bad and not realise it? And then I saw some clip online the other day that someone posted, and it was John Cleese talking about stupid people. Have you seen
it? No.
He was saying that the problem with really stupid people is that they're too stupid to realise how stupid they are.
Mm.
And I think that's actually pretty true. Like, you have to be reasonably good at something in order to be aware of how bad you are.
Completely true. There's something, have you heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
No.
No.
Psychological study saying exactly that.
Ah, okay.
So chart it on a graph, you'd have competence across the bottom, confidence up the side. So at the very start, your competence is virtually zero.
Yeah.
But very soon in, you reach absolute peak of confidence. So it's a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, basically. Yeah. And then as soon as you get a bit more competent, on this graph I've got here, it calls that first the peak of Mount Stupid. This first bit where you know next to nothing, but you walk around like you go, yes, well, actually. Yeah. And then very soon after that, it's like it's like a roller coaster, vroom, straight down to the valley of despair, because you suddenly become slightly competent and think, oh my God, I don't know anything about this. And then there's a very gentle slope all the way back up to the heights of Mount Stupid, but much, much further along the line when you can call yourself, I don't know, a guru or an expert or do a TED talk or something like that. Maybe it would be more interesting if they got people from Mount Stupid to do TED Talks, wouldn't it? That'd be hilarious.
Yeah, really, really.
Some bloke
short.
Who's like read a couple. I read a couple of Wikipedia articles. Of course, I'll do your TED Talk on heart surgery. Yeah,
but yeah, just supremely confident for about 10 seconds. That'd be a great little TED Talk, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but that would be a good TED Talk on the Dunning-Kruger effects if you had someone to come and sweep up afterwards, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But I think that's the point: is that you have to be reasonably good at writing in order to recognize when you've written something bad.
If you're bad at writing, would you realize you'd written something good?
Well, you just wouldn't know. You just, you know, you're so bad at it, you've got no concept of anything. Yeah,
you'd basically be that monkey in the monkey cage, wouldn't you?
Just splodging words,
banging away
page.
On that typewriter.
Yeah. I'm still no closer to knowing whether I'm any good at writing or not after this conversation.
Well, I know, we're just going round in circles, aren't we?
Apparently, it's scientifically proven that people who squeeze the toothpaste from the middle of the tube and people who stick their fingers in peanut butter jars are the same kind of people who don't bother leaving a review for the Failing Writers podcast. So, I mean, what kind of person do you want to be? Just saying.
So, any other little nuggets of what constitutes
any niggly nuggets?
I've got no more niggly nuggets.
Right.
Tommy?
I'm very much a feel person for bad writing, I'm afraid.
Right. Well, you know.
Like,
that's
I would
all right.
pick up a book and go, oof, I can't read this.
But you wouldn't necessarily know why, you mean?
Yeah. Or... I don't think I'd look into it, maybe, but I don't think I would necessarily know why. No, I don't think I'd, yeah. Whereas there's some stuff you think, oh, yeah, this is, wow, this works. This is good.
Yeah, yeah.
This is well written.
Yeah.
You use that phrase, don't you? Well written. As if there's like, and everyone does. Everyone does. Oh, this is well written.
It's like we all know what that means.
You go, oh, why? Oh, well,
I
mean, it is, isn't it?
It just is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It just is.
It was really interesting that you sent a tweet that was about the Crawdads, Where the Crawdads Sing.
There was a little discussion online, wasn't
there? And it was hilarious because someone had put this.
Talk about the Marmite of books.
Yeah. Someone had put something like, oh, I haven't read a good book for ages, and then I read this and my heart sang or something.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, there were just so many comments that were totally like the opposite end of the scale.
Yeah, like, this is properly terrible.
There were loads that said, oh, God, yeah, it was one of the best things I've read in ages. And there were other ones going, this was a terrible book.
It's amazing, isn't it, that something can be that
polarizing?
Yeah.
There was another great example. What was it? It was, hang on, give me 1 second. Hang on. Wait a minute. Hold that thought.
This is more great entertainment, isn't it? I mean, this is what keeps people hooked.
Oh, that's it. So did either of you see WandaVision?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. There was a quote in that, which is a very similar sort of thing. So it was a quote from the movie, and someone posted it online basically saying how brilliant it was. And it was like the great schism of 1640, whatever. It just seemed to cut the world in half of people who were like, yes, this is brilliant. And other people just going, no, this is rubbish. This is awful. So the line was, what is grief if not love persevering? And someone had posted a tweet that said, and the world of screenwriters all went, ooh. And yeah, it was like a full-scale war broke out. People saying, yeah, that is a pretty good line. And other people who'd never written a word in their lives just going, that's just the worst kind of garbage.
Why such strong opinions?
I don't know. It's like just six words. But why would you go to such lengths to talk about bad writing? Why would you go to the lengths of making a whole show about what's any good or not?
The thing is, it irks people.
Yeah.
It really does.
It really does.
It gets their goat. Like, all their goat. It gets.
Yeah.
Because when the books we will come on to where we've given ourselves, we've sent them to each other to read because they're well-known bad books, if you like, inverted commas.
Yep.
When it's something that some people find good and some, I think people have a real, like, do you know what, it doesn't compute with them and they get angry about it. Because they can't, how could you possibly, do you mean, that's when people get really angry, isn't it? When they just can't see the other person's point of view and they are wrong. They're just wrong. They're wrong. How can you? And they just can't leave it. Dog with a bone tie. And you can't.
Was it Will Storr who was talking about that? About the, you know, how people find it impossible to understand other people's point of view.
Yeah, I don't agree with what he said.
Sorry. So, Tommy.
Yeah.
What book did you get?
Oh, right. Well, I got Irene Iddesleigh, which was confusing.
Is that the title?
Yeah, that's the title.
That's a great title, isn't it?
This lady who wrote around the turn of the previous century in the olden days, Amanda McKittrick Ross. By all accounts, from I did a bit of research, she was quite a abrupt and brash Irish lady, I think. And yeah, she didn't really, it was criticised quite heavily at the time.
What year are we talking, roughly?
About 1897
roughly,
or something like that.
Okay.
And I think it's unfair looking from where we are now because it is written in that style of that time as well. Do you know what I mean? There was a lot of quite flowery writing knocking around at that time. I guess of the time again, your main protagonist, that would be the title of the book, almost, wouldn't it? You know, Emma, Irene Iddesleigh, very much birds of a feather. Not birds of a feather. I meant they were not the latest. That was a much later sitcom. But I don't know if have you heard of C.S. Lewis?
Yeah. I have.
And a chap called Tolkien.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were in a literary group.
All right.
Called Ye Olde Failing. No, it wasn't. Called Inklings. Inklings.
Nice.
They were going to come up with a clever name, weren't they? So, I mean, obviously. Yeah. So they met in this society.
Mm. She was like the duffer of the group.
No, she didn't meet. They just brought her a book to laugh at, basically. So they had a game in this.
Sorry,
they had a game in this group where they met together, and their game would be to read one of her works, often Irene Iddesleigh, and see who could do it for longest without laughing.
Interesting.
So yeah, but she didn't like the criticism. It's fair to say. Do you know what I did find that was interesting as well? Do you know who published the original, the very first? It was her publisher was. W&G Baird.
What's it? Always.
It was a Baird. It was a Baird publication.
Always been at the forefront of taste.
All of a sudden, everything fell into place.
So that would be what your great 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 grandfather Birdie.
Could be, yeah, could be.
What I did make me laugh. In her last novel, which was called Helen Huddleston.
She's as bad at coming up with names as Birdie is.
That was the protagonist, therefore that was the title of the book.
Right.
The other characters in the book were named after fruits and vegetables.
Shut up.
So
Colin the Carrot?
You had aristocrats like Lord Raspberry and Sir Christopher Current.
No.
Yeah, and then further down the social scale, is this a ladybird times, book? You would have Madame Pear and Lily Lentil, the servant girl. So I think, you know, we're saying whether it's, can you say it's bad? I think you can just say, yes, that's bad writing. You shouldn't call all your characters after foods. Could you really?
But again, there's a certain point where you think you couldn't accidentally do that and think it was a good idea. Sure, at some point, you've got to think, maybe she knew. Maybe she did.
She knew that people didn't like it, but she just didn't agree and belligerently carried on. Do you mind? She wasn't a one-hit wonder. She wrote three or four books.
Could you give us a little bit, Tommy? Have you got a bit underlined that we can enjoy?
Well, like Dave said, what I wanted to do was share with you two.
Okay. So we're going to start the game.
I think we need to, really, yeah.
And we need to guess which one. Okay. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
And I shall begin. When the house was out of sight, I sat with my birdcage in the straw at my feet, forward on the low seat, to look out of the high window, watching the frosty trees that were like beautiful pieces of spar, and the fields all smooth and white with last night's snow, and the sun so red but yielding so little heat, and the ice dark like metal where the skaters and sliders had brushed the snow away. There was a gentleman in the coach who sat on the opposite seat and looked very large in a quantity of wrappings, but he sat gazing out of the other window and took no notice of me. So that was the first one.
Mm. Okay.
No matter in what light he viewed her conduct now, he was brought to loathe her very look, and was fully determined to shut her in from the gaze of an outside world or the cunning tricks of a trifling tutor. He was resolved, so far as lay in his power, to treat her with the conduct she merited, and never again allow himself to be persuaded to postpone the visitation of his anger by her villainous, pitiful appeals. So one of those is widely regarded as a terrible writer, possibly one of the worst in the world ever. Ooh. And the other, I don't know if you've heard of the guy, wrote around the same time, Chaz Dickens.
Mm. Okay.
Heard of Dickens? So, I mean, you should have answered by now, really.
The first one was very simplistic language, but that, you see, interesting. It was easier to follow, wasn't it? It's a lot easier to follow. But interestingly, I think it's tricky when you take things out of context, isn't it? Because if you're already into the book and you know what somebody's talking about, you're kind of in there and it's fine. But if you're suddenly jumping into a particular scene, it's actually quite confusing unless someone's describing something.
But surely that, in terms of the technical business of writing, that's the point. It should still work without being entwined into the story.
Why should it? I disagree. I think
because in terms of the mechanical, technical element of good writing.
Well, not if you don't know what came before. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Also, I can't remember either of them now, so I couldn't tell
I think the lady writer is the first one. It was very simple. It wasn't. It wasn't sort of. You see, but that could be a good thing. It was very easy to understand. It set a scene quite well. But the second one...
Is there a prize?
See, Dickens did like a long sentence. He could be quite verbose.
Yeah.
So, I think out of context, it's really difficult.
Yeah.
I reckon if you read the first paragraph of the book, we'd be able to tell. But then with Charles Dickens, it's probably easier to tell what the book is.
Yeah. Quite famous for his openings, wasn't he?
Okay, I'm gonna put my cards on the table. I'm gonna say
to have to rush you for an answer.
I'm gonna say I'm just gonna pick at random because I don't know. I'm gonna
That's
say
no good. I'm gonna Come say on. Dickens. Come on, John.
Can you put some game show music on this, Tom, to make it sound more exciting?
Bad, I'm gonna say the second one is a bad a difficult bit of Dickens.
Dave?
I'm gonna say because I've no idea, I'm gonna go for the first one as being Dickens. Just so that one of us is right.
You see, Dave, this is why we hold you up as the arbiter of classic literature on this podcast. Because you know your stuff. You know your stuff.
Yep.
That first one was Dickens.
See, I always say it doesn't matter how you get there. It's the winning that's important.
Yeah.
But I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
It was. It was better, wasn't it? As in you could see something.
Yeah.
I thought you'd chosen a really difficult bit of Dickens deliberately.
No, I probably chose the most... easy to read part of her.
Sneaky.
That's probably
double
the easiest bit. I was interested with the Dickens one, how you could look at that And you wonder now whether, so if Dickens sent his book off to the editors or whatever, what would come back? Do you mean, would they go, look, you can't have this wandering sentence in here with all your ands and your ands and your ands.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Come on.
But also, would they say, you know, you've just gone on about Lady Courgette or whatever she was called. Lord Raspberry. Dickens had some utterly ridiculous names for his characters as well, didn't he?
No, he did not. Yeah. Come on, name any. Seriously.
Mrs. Chuzzlewit.
Come on, that's a good old-fashioned
Henry Fonselby and all that sort of thing. But
Uriah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they are good, though, as well, aren't they?
Oh, they're good. But that's the thing. Weird. There's a skill to nonsense, isn't there? You know what I mean? Like, some people are very, very good at making up nonsense names that just sound right. Mm. And other people...
Don't tell me you're not sat there now, Dave, thinking, hold on a minute, Bobby Banana.
Would work, wouldn't it?
That might work.
Something's just, yeah. Something's
because he's a policeman, which is a peeler. Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, it works. It's got on a variety of levels.
Used to do as well. Dickens used to imbibe some character into the name.
Yeah,
as well,
it tells you a bit about
it. Would often reflect something in the character. Would be in the name.
Yeah.
Which name them after fruits and vegetables? Less so. I mean, depending, I don't know what they look like, maybe. Yeah. Maybe Madame Pear looked like a pear.
Well, yeah, fair shape.
Maybe Lord Raspberry had a really bad lisp. But yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Well.
Do you want me to read you another bit out of the...
go on then.
Yes, I would.
The worst book ever written. Instinctively, Ray reached out an arm towards the wounded man, only for it to be swept away by a bloody fist. That'll be fun for anyone that listened to last week's episode.
Yes. Yes, thank
you. You're welcome.
Right, I've got a bit here now.
So what was your book again? Remind me what your book again was, Dave.
Well, this book is called Empress Teresa. And if you want to know anything about this book, just look at the front cover. I mean, they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but this one you actually can judge the book by its
guy,
cover.
I think the guy painted it himself, didn't he?
Almost certainly. Because no human would commission a drawing like this and accept it as the cover for their book if someone else did it. Anyway, that's not really the point, is it? That's the cover of the book. I've got to be perfectly honest with you, chaps. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the whole thing, so it would be utterly remiss of me to say that it's bad, because I haven't read the whole thing, so I couldn't possibly judge it. All I can say is that the bits I have read of it, you know, I was saying that some people just are able to make things sound interesting and other people don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think this falls into the latter category.
Right.
But I don't know what it is about it. So it's just, it's missing that X factor, if you like.
Okay, so it's not just, like, absolutely wrong.
Well, so, I mean, no, it's just, some bits of it are, but like, there's just, well, I'll tell you what.
Do you think it's been written by AI? Has it got that feel to it?
Well, but this is another interesting...
just being soulless.
There is that element, but also, what I sort of realised as I was reading it last night, some of it I was thinking, oh God, this is quite sort of funny that it's so bad. But then I thought, actually, it is a first-person narrative.
Mm.
And the lead character is a 10-year-old girl. So on a certain level, you wouldn't expect it to be sort of, you know, really brilliant prose. But I'm not entirely sure that defence holds up all the way through. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. One of the hardest things to write, I think, is dialogue.
Mm.
So I'm going to read a passage of dialogue written by a very well-respected, internationally known author who's been mentioned on this podcast a few times, and then I'm going to read a passage of dialogue from Empress Teresa, and you have to see if you can guess which is which. Okay. Right, so first one. Tommy, I said quite sternly, there's mud all over your shirt. So what? He mumbled. But even as he said this, he looked down and noticed the brown specks and only just stopped himself crying out in alarm. Then I saw the surprise register on his face. I should know about his feelings for the polo shirt. It's nothing to worry about, I said before the silence got humiliating for him. It'll come off. If you can't get it off yourself, just take it to Miss Jodie. He went on examining his shirt, then said grumpily, there's nothing to do with you anyway. Right, so that's one example. Okay.
It's not much to go on there, was
there?
But yeah.
No, but dialogue is tricky, is the point you're trying to make. I wasn't very enthusiastic about telling the story. Jan Struthers had to force it out of me one tiny piece at a time. How long did that take? Like that. I snapped my fingers at the phone. Did you feel anything? Nope. Did this white ball look solid like a steel ball? Nope. Fuzzy like cotton. What happened then? I ran into the house and waited. Then I ate breakfast. I thought I was going crazy. How long after the white ball jumped at you did the fire trucks come? Half an hour. Did the white thing change you in any way? No. Does it make sounds or talk to you? No. Have you seen it again? No. It's like it went away. How have you been eating lately? Like I always do.
Okay.
So, one of those is from Empress Teresa. Other one isn't.
One of them isn't.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you've tried to make us think the second one is from the Rubbish One.
Have
here,
I? Haven't
you?
Tom?
Yeah, but I think that's what
have
you did, I? Tommy, as well.
I just innocently, randomly picked two sections of of text from contemporary authors themselves. Yeah. Now, you see, the first one was bad, inverted commas, wasn't it? Because, all the he said grumpily and all that business everywhere, all over it. And that's something that's widely frowned on, isn't it, by the writing community.
Adverbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, yep. I hate them. Absolutely hate them. Even though sometimes they are quite useful, but you'll get shot at dawn for saying that on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that was bad because of that. The second one was bad because it was hard to follow, but part of me thinks, was it written in order for it to be bad? Was that character coming
but
out?
But again, it was totally out of context, wasn't it? It was like, who?
Yeah, so you don't know if one of the characters has
the
a
person.
Yeah.
We have no idea. Yeah. Is it a doctor or a psychologist or what? I mean,
I think it's even harder with dialogue, isn't it? Because you're a prisoner to the characters.
Yeah, you could be talking about
anything.
You're
communicating anyway. So if they've communicated throughout the, because they're autistic or whatever throughout the book, so they've got a very specific way of communicating, then. So, yes, naughty Dave, basically very naughty.
Mm. So, what are we saying then?
Yeah, neither of them were, particularly bad in their context, were they? So nothing, stood out horrendously, apart from what Tom was saying about adverbs.
Yeah.
But I think the second one, because I'm really good at this game, I think the second one is the supposedly good writer I'm going to go for.
Okay. Tom?
I think I'd agree with that, actually.
Right.
Unless it's wrong, and then I'll change my mind.
Well, I can tell you that today's jackpot is going to roll over.
No!
Because that first bit of dialogue was written by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yeah, thought it was.
From his popular novel, Never Let Me Go. And the second bit of dialogue was from Empress Teresa by Norman Bouton.
It does.
Bouton. So there you go,
see,
just
Tommy,
goes to show.
Tommy barely did the same thing
no,
as you.
No, the thing is, though, if that second bit was meant
sneaky.
To be... If that, well, I don't know, but that's kind of the point, though, isn't it? You've got to be sneaky.
Exactly, because this is a game show, John.
No, but I think that's the point of what we're trying to discuss, though, isn't it? That there's a context and a subjectivity to all of it. But so that second bit could be brilliant writing if it completely disrupts the flow of something as a new character comes in and has a completely different way. But if the whole thing's written like that and that's their idea of good flowing dialogue, then that's where you go, well, this is terrible. This is unreadable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it mostly goes to show that context is everything.
Context is king, isn't
it? Yeah, it's not everything, but it's...
No.
I think, it changes an awful lot, doesn't it?
And the actual writing, obviously. makes.
Yes.
I'm going to be fair to you guys, and I'm going to read the first bit of the novel. The
trouble is, this is where it gets more embarrassing when we get it wrong now.
Well, it does, yeah. Yeah. Right. But it's fair. So, and I think it's possibly says more about the writing. I don't know. I could be wrong. Let's find out.
In the next thrilling round of Good Book, Bad Book.
Implacable November weather and much mud in the streets, as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill, smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, indistinguishable in mire, horses scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers, foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper, and losing their foothold at street corners where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if the day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest.
Or bully special prize.
Now you've got that, you've got that, Dave. You've got that paragraph. Do you want to gamble?
That's safe.
And Adam Salton sauntered into the Empire Club, Sydney, and found awaiting him a letter from his granduncle. He had first heard from the old gentleman less than a year before, when Richard Salton had claimed kinship, stating that he'd been unable to write earlier as he'd found it very difficult to trace his grandnephew's address. Adam was delighted and replied cordially. He had often heard his father speak of the older branch of the family with whom his people had long lost touch. Some interesting correspondence had ensued. Adam eagerly opened the letter, which had only just arrived, and conveyed a cordial invitation to stop with his granduncle at Lesser Hill for as long a time as he could spare. "Indeed," Richard Salton went on, "I am in hopes that you will make your permanent home here. You see, my dear boy, you and I are all that remain of our race, and it is but fitting that you should succeed me when the time comes, in this year of grace, 1860. I am close on 80 years of age, and though we have been a long-lived race, the span of life cannot be prolonged beyond reasonable bounds. I am prepared to like you, and to make your home with me as happy as you could wish."
Right.
One of them, because I don't think I've mentioned what book I got sent.
No, that's true. But a little bit of context would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it? It might be useful. I got sent a book called The Lair of the White Worm by Bram Stoker.
Ah.
I thought that was a cunning book to send you, John. That's why,
yes.
Why you got sent that. Because I know you like your classic literature. And I don't know if you know, Bram Stoker actually wrote a pretty good book.
He did.
Quite a well-known book.
Relatively well-known one.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, that's interesting. How come one of his other books is getting panned and said that?
I mean, it's got to be good, right? If Bram wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll come to that in a minute. In the meantime, have you got any thoughts?
Right. I preferred the first one.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was getting a bit flowery. A bit sort of overuse of descriptive words and just didn't quite seem to have as much of a point as the first one.
It felt like it was desperately trying to force facts down your throat, didn't it?
I've also, again, already forgotten the first one, but I know that I do remember that I liked it.
I'd know it if I heard it again.
I liked the bit about the ice compound, you know.
I think as well with the first one, with it being a very well-known opening to a Dickens novel, I think that one's probably not.
It did sound quite Dickensian, didn't it?
You don't read literature.
Yeah, but I have to know stuff. So
oh, I see.
I do.
Okay.
Do you not remember saying to Will Storr how good his book was?
Because it just. But there is no chance that Tommy will have read Bleak House.
I haven't read it.
Just read the first. Tom just reads the first.
It's a pub quiz question, isn't it? Yeah, anything that's a pub quiz question, potentially, I'm fine on. That's fine. Actually putting in the hard work and reading it. So, yeah. Regardless, there was definitely that feel in the second one of it just being a bit too dry and...
It's boring, yeah. I think.
It's boring,
it's just a bit boring.
Yeah. Just, that's a very good way of putting it, yeah. And it just, because you feel like you're just being fed these, here's all the information I'll need you to know immediately for my story to work, kind of feeling to it, which is... Whereas Dickens, obviously, his opening lines for stuff was all about dragging you into the world, wasn't
colourful.
It?
Yes, colourful.
It's really, the language is really thick, isn't it, with meaning and metaphor and stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
but you can also instantly sort of see things. It starts to conjure.
That's it, it's visual, isn't it? Whereas,
which I guess is the definition of good writing, isn't it, in terms of...
The second one was just felt like it was trying to be clever for cleverness's sake.
Yeah, I mean, possibly the other problem with it is that it's not setting a scene, is it?
No, there's no real visuals in that.
Yeah,
is there?
It's just info. It's telling, not showing, isn't it?
It was like the start to Star Wars.
Yeah.
I always hated the start to Star Wars. You know, with all the words
all
going
the words
through space.
Coming down.
I'm like, I remember as a big thing. I don't know who's who here. Who's which one's the Republic? I don't even know which ones. I don't know. I'm none the wiser. You didn't need to do that. Just get onto the ships and the firing.
Can I read you another
please
bit?
Yeah, please.
This is page two, and I think this is a classic. This is probably one of the reasons why this book is quite often...
Can I ask you a quick question first, John? Have you read the entire book? Or did you manage to read
it? No, I got about halfway, and I thought, that's enough for me.
Right. And what was it? Was it the writing style or the content or just...
Oh, it's so dull and right. weird, and you don't care about anybody. And well, I'll read this, and you'll
okay.
get it straight
yeah,
away.
Yeah, go on.
I've written little notes in the margin. I'm just reading this one.
Kill me now. I hate myself.
This is torture. Like, that. Like really? Stuff like that. So this is literally page two. So we've just had that bit before.
Yeah.
So we've learnt that
everything.
Someone is coming from Australia to England.
Sydney. Yeah.
And if you want to get across a journey, I mean normally you just sort of go and he arrived in Britain. But no, there's quite a lot of this. So, but I'll just read a little bit. Mr. Sultan gave instructions to have ready a carriage early on the important day to start for Stafford, where he would catch the 11:40 a.m. train. He would stay that night with his grandnephew either on the ship, which would be a new experience for him, or if his guest should prefer it, at a hotel. In either case, they would start in the early morning for home. He'd given instructions to his bailiff to send the postillion carriage on to Southampton to be ready for their journey home and to arrange for relays of his own horses to be sent on at once. He intended that his grandnephew, who had been all his life in Australia, should see something of rural England on the drive. He had plenty of young horses of his own breeding and breaking and could depend on a journey memorable to the young man. The luggage would be sent on by rail to Stafford.
I'm glad he said that. I was worried about the luggage, actually. Yeah,
where one of his carts would meet it. Mr. Sultan, during the journey to Southampton, it's like the travel arrangements.
Yes.
It's not even like a travelogue. It is literally...
Bram Stoker's like the guy that you meet at the party that no one else is talking to, and you accidentally start talking to you. So we actually came on the A63. Normally, we wouldn't. We'd use the bypass because obviously that does get busy. And the occasion we took the train, a funny story, isn't it? It's just like...
It's someone who'd be really good at my dad's road quiz.
Yes. It definitely sounds like he would say, cut a long story short, and then just carry on going.
And then carry on, yeah. What's he thinking? I mean, obviously...
I find it astonishing.
Come on, Bram, stretch your mind. Use a nice metaphor.
Was that... At what point of his career was this?
This is the weird thing, right? This is right at the end of his career.
Ah, there you go, see.
So he's either gone mad...
We had this discussion. I think we had a little discussion off air, didn't we? About the fact that sometimes people can get so big... And so sort of self-important that they stop having, stop having anyone to edit.
Maybe he was even testing how far he could push.
Maybe somebody said to him,
"How shit can I write before people stop buying this stuff?"
People used to say things about certain comedians and say, "Oh, he could read the telephone book and make me laugh." Perhaps someone had said that about Bram Stoker. He go, "Oh, you could write the telephone book and I'd find it interesting." And he went,
"I can write more boring than that." He said. There
it's
you
a
go.
Challenge.
Maybe it was a bet.
Write a whole book without putting anything interesting in it.
God, he was a massive racist as well.
Was he?
Oh Jesus! Just trying to find. It. I mean, there's.
I mean, don't read him out, John.
Quite,
but
he calls there's an African character that he calls.
I'll do. Read
I'm gonna read it out. There's an African character he calls Ulanga, and it says, "But the face of Ulanga was unreformed, unsoftened, savage." And inherent in it were all the hideous possibilities of a lost, devil-ridden child of the forest and the swamp, the lowest of all created things that could be regarded as in some form ostensibly human.
Jesus Christ.
And then a bit later on in the book, he says...
And then he goes on to say, but some of my best friends.
Later on in the book, he says, you might think to look at him that you could measure in some way the extent of his vileness. This poor guy has literally done nothing.
Is it still the same guy?
Same, we're talking about
Ulanga.
Still Ulanga,
right.
He
literally,
I mean, he hasn't done
really
anything wrong.
Really doesn't like him,
does But he? You might think to look at him that you could measure in some way the extent of his vileness, but it would be a vain hope. Monsters such as he is belong to an earlier and more rudimentary stage of barbarism. He is, in his way, a clever fellow... But is none the less dangerous or the less hateful for that. What have I written in the margin? I've written...
Racist bastards.
Nothing more terrifying to a white man than a clever black man
in
those days. Wow. Yeah, quite stunning.
It makes calling people after fruits and vegetables seem quite nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so,
quite chilled.
Could have just called him Lord Raspberry.
It's a god-awful book. It is quite stunning. I need to find another bit that particularly... I took a particular shine to.
Don't say that, because that makes you sound like you really enjoyed the
Oh, God, where is it? Oh, here we go. So he's explaining that a bit of a, you know, a darkness fell over the land. It was just like, there was just a bad feeling across the land. In place of these things was only a soundless gloom, more dreadful, more disheartening, more soul-killing than any concourse of sounds, no matter how full of fear and dread. Pious individuals put up constant prayers for relief from the intolerable solitude. After a little, there were signs of universal depression, which those who ran might read. One and all, the faces of men and women seemed bereft of vitality, of interest, of thought, and most of all, of hope. Men seemed to have lost the power of expression of their thoughts. The soundless air seemed to have the same effect as the universal darkness. When men gnawed their tongues with pain from this infliction of silence, there was no relief. Everything was affected. Gloom was the predominant note. Joy appeared to have passed away as a factor of life, and this creative impulse had nothing to take its place. This giant spot in high air was a plague of evil influence. It seemed like a new misanthropic belief which had fallen on human beings, carrying with it the negation of all hope. After a few days, men began to grow desperate. Their very words, as well as their senses, seemed to be in chains. And it goes on from there as well. And it's like, yes. Oh my God, I think we've got it now.
I didn't know whether for a second whether you were reading the book or a review of the book. Because I felt a lot of those things I was feeling.
You just need to stop now, yeah. Bram.
Just edit. Just stop. Edit, Bram. Edit. Go back and have a look.
Even though you say that, as you were reading that, I did think, if you were to read that in the voice of Kenneth Williams... probably make it sound a lot more interesting.
Yeah, he could make it funny, couldn't he?
He could read the phone book and make it funny. Yeah, no, that is terrible, John, isn't it, actually?
It is quite bad.
When we're talking about all this objective, subjective stuff, but no, that's just...
Some stuff. I mean, that's
just really bad. I've got one more little bit to give you. I know it hurts, but just one last bit, which I thought was interesting.
This is like John's like, well, I had to read a lot of this, so now everyone else
do this one in the voice of Frank Spencer.
That worked, which I think what Bram Stoker had in mind, to be honest.
Yeah,
I mean the whole I think you're right. Very much misinterpreted, wasn't it? That was meant to be much more of a music hall sort of vibe to it. But everyone made it very dark.
I think in an early draft, Dracula comes flying out of his castle on a pair of roller skates and disappears down the mountain.
With jazz hands flying.
From the local sports centre where they're having a blood drive, where there was a blood banners.
So you know how they say show, don't tell.
I'm already feeling this one, John.
This book is full of stuff like this. So this is only a little tiny bit, but the cordiality with which Sir Nathaniel and Adam met made the imparting of information easy. Sir Nathaniel was a clever man of the world who had travelled much and within a certain area studied deeply. He was a brilliant conversationalist, as was to be expected from a successful diplomatist, even under unstimulating conditions. But he'd been touched and to a certain extent fired by the young man's evident admiration and willingness to learn from him. Accordingly, the conversation, which began on the most friendly basis, soon warmed to an interest above proof.
No, you lost me at the start, mate. I have this image of Bram Stoker in his sort of darkened library, sat on his leather writing table with his pens writing this stuff, and then finishing for the day and sort of walking out. And his wife saying, how's it going, Bram? Oh, marvellous. I am writing some of the best stuff I have ever written. Can I read it? You don't need to. It's brilliant. Honestly, first draft, absolute award winner.
That's why he died
soon
after.
Killed him. That's probably why he died. She's probably read it. She's probably read it and thought, I've got to stop
him
writing
the world
anymore.
A favor.
What struck me about that bit, you know, I think we were talking about... not that long ago, we were talking about Dave's murder mystery
book.
How
does that fit into this week's discussion topic, John?
You know how Dave was struggling with actually writing the material of the comedy?
Yeah.
And that was sort of slowing you down. That doesn't seem to have slowed Bram Stoker down. Because he's basically saying they had a hilarious and brilliant conversation, but he's not willing to tell us what they actually said.
Yes. I'm not going to say what the words
again,
were.
Imagine him at his leather writing desk, maybe giving that 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then just going, no, yeah, that's enough. They don't need to know any more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good conversation.
I love
good
that. I just love the fact that he's just told us how brilliant these guys are and how hilarious and fascinating the conversation is. Yeah.
Yes.
Show, don't tell.
So what do you reckon we've learnt here today? Have we learned anything?
I don't know, really. Has it changed anyone's perception of good or bad writing, or what it? I think John's point about the context becomes all more. See, that's. I think that makes it all the more. You know, when people say about 50 Shades of Grey or Dan Brown is another one, isn't it? People have very strong feelings,
yeah.
And a lot of that is kind of like, I don't know. Well, with Dan Brown, there seems to be all kinds of criticism of structure and story and writing and everything, yeah. But he's sold a
massive bestseller,
hasn't he?
Multi-millionaire.
I think as well, if you can follow it and you're interested,
then the story works, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that's enough, isn't it? I mean, not everybody's trying to write high literature.
I've brought up Dan Brown very intentionally, so I can share with you a quote I found on the internet. So someone had asked, "Why does everyone think Dan Brown's books are terrible?" And someone answered, "I would prefer to be waterboarded than be forced to read another book by the odious Dan Brown, a man who could be said to be a writer in the same sense that a woodpecker is a carpenter."
But that's the thing, though, because I remember reading. I read The Da Vinci Code on holiday. I was one of those people. Took it on holiday with me.
Yeah,
what's the fuss about?
Yeah, I read it on
holiday. I enjoyed it. I don't remember any of it, but that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. But no,
it rattled along, didn't it?
Yeah, it just rattled through it. It was quite interesting. The ending was a bit like, really? Yeah. But, you know.
And the writing's quite big.
Exactly, yeah. I've read worse books.
The thing about The Lair of the White Worm as well, which makes it particularly annoying, is that words are tiny. So when I got it, I thought, oh, that's good. That's a really short little book. And then you open it up and they cram so many bloody words onto the page.
You bastards.
Almost impossible to read.
I think that's an interesting thing, though, isn't it? Because, you know, I sort of said about perhaps some people have just got something that other people haven't. But even within a single author's work, you can find some stuff that's spectacularly good and popular and, you know, like obviously Bram Stoker, and then something that's just not.
Back to that thing of, though, hitting the zeitgeist, isn't it? Kind of, you know, it's the right place at the right time as well. With the story itself.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
Because people throw that at J.K. Rowling as well now, don't they? And say, you know, she's just phoning it in for the recent stuff compared with the early stuff. But then some people have a go at the early stuff and say, Harry Potter's terrible.
Thing is, if something's popular, there's always going to be a hater.
Some stuff just works and becomes better than its constituent parts, doesn't it? You can't really explain why something that's brilliant is brilliant. Yeah. It just is. But it's ridiculous to think that everything that person does is going to be brilliant.
Yeah.
Three cheers for your ears. Thanks for listening to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Hey, have you ever heard of the Bulwer-Lytton Prize? Did you come across that in your research?
No, what's that?
In my extensive research.
It's a prize. It's an award named after the novelist and playwright Edward Bulwer-Lytton. And particularly, he's the guy who wrote It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. He wrote that opener.
Really?
And it's a contest. It basically asks writers to submit, or anybody to submit an opening sentence for the worst of all possible novels. So you basically just send in the first sentence, and there are some absolute crackers. Would you like to hear some?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
How about these for novel openers? Sue Fondry, this is. Cheryl's mind turned like the vanes of a wind-powered turbine, chopping her sparrow-like thoughts into bloody pieces that fell onto a growing pile of forgotten memories. It's quite nice, isn't it?
In the context of the stuff we've been reading, that sounds quite
good. Doesn't sound that bad, does it?
Sounds quite exciting, though. I want to know more.
This is the point. If you try to make something deliberately bad, it actually has a good quality to it. Yeah.
It's true. This next one is a good one. It's Ali Kawashima. As the dark and mysterious stranger approached, Angela bit her lip anxiously. hoping with every nerve, cell, and fibre of her being that this would be the one man who would understand, who would take her away from all this, and who would not just squeeze her boob and make a loud honking noise as all the others had.
That's actually good writing, that, though, isn't it? That's reeled you in with some light cliches.
Bosh.
Here's another one from Chris Wylock. She strutted into my office wearing a dress that clung to her like saran wrap to a sloppily butchered pork knuckle, bone and sinew jutting and lurching asymmetrically beneath its folds, the tightness exaggerating the granularity of the suet and causing what little palatable meat there was to sweat. Its transparency, the thief of imagination.
I used to work with someone like that.
Did that remind you of something?
It's good.
But that's the thing. See, these are all too good because they're trying to be bad.
Yeah, I think you're right, dude.
They're just too good.
Are they trying to be bad, though? I'm not sure.
Oh,
I looked them up and they were all proper writers.
But that's the thing. The competition is to write the worst possible opening sentence for a book, isn't it?
Possibly.
But if you try to make it bad.
Is this not just a product, though, of how people enjoy mocking writing so much?
I think that's probably right.
It's back to C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, isn't it? Having a good old laugh at Amanda McKittrick Ross's expense.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, do you know what I mean? Turn on his Tolkien. There's a few passages in your book that you could have a look at.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
I like to think that at the same time, Amanda McKittrick Ross and Bram Stoker had a group where they would get together and mock walking through a wardrobe into a different land. I mean, that's just stupid, isn't it?
So if we've learned anything, it's that everything's subjective, isn't it? So
I think the question is, that answers all of this, if J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, but everyone in it was named after a fruit or vegetable, would it still work as a book? Would it be rubbish?
Harry Potato!
Harry Potato and the Grocer of Azkaban. There we go. That's our weighty conclusion, isn't it?
Yep, I think debate? What we've done is we've just solved it, haven't we? So I don't think anyone really has to talk about it anymore because we've wrapped it up comprehensively.
Of course, the problem is now we've got no excuse for writing crap stuff.
Oh, we have, John. We have. You've seen how famous you can get writing crap stuff.
Good point.
This character from Lord of the Rings? They cut him out of the movie.
Honestly, they cut
him out of the films. There's a bit where they're having their walk. And then they just get to this house.
They're having their little walk.
Go for a nice little stroll.
What is Lord of the Rings about?
Do you want
to
come for a walk? I'll come for a walk. About 4 days into the walk, he's like, it's quite a long walk.
This is a long walk, isn't it? Where are we going?
No, we've got more walking to do. Still walking.
Where's everybody gone?